The book of Esther is in both Greek and Hebrew called Esther, as she is clearly the main character. Esther, the events of Esther take place between 483 BC and 473 BC, and you may ask, well, how do you know that? Well, there are a couple of really good hints. Look first at chapter 2, verse 16. It's nice for people who are trying to date books and their events, when right in the book it tells you exactly when things happen. And that happens here in chapter 2, verse 16. It says, "So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus to his royal palace in the 10th month, which is in the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign." So we think, are fairly certain that King Ahasuerus is, does anybody know? Is Xerxes? Anybody know what country or people Xerxes was the king of? Persia. Very good. Does anybody know why we know Xerxes' name? What did he do other than be king of Persia? What did he do while he was king of Persia? What did he try to do while he was king of Persia unsuccessfully? Yeah, he attacked the Greeks, right? And we have the 300 and their battle at Thermopylae and all that cool stuff. So that's the time period we're talking about, just to give you an idea. Also in chapter 3, verse 7, so 2:16 is probably in about 479 BC, and the events of chapter 3, verse 7 are in about 474 BC. So really, we have 10 chapters here, but it's important to remember that from the very beginning to the very end of the book, we skip a few years in there. We've got a couple years time frame, and obviously the book focuses in on a few days in particular, but there is some time that passes as we move through the book of Esther. The purpose of the book of Esther looks much like this. The physical seed of Abraham, while the physical seed of Abraham was not faithful to Yahweh, what we're going to see with the Jews in this book are they are very ambiguous. We're not exactly sure about their spiritual condition, quite frankly. We see that they are wise, that they are brave, and that they understand that God is going to protect the Jews. But a couple of things that we're going to see, you never see the name of God mentioned. You never see the word Yahweh mentioned. You never have him, they don't pray. They don't talk about Jerusalem or Israel or the temple or any of those types of things. So frankly, it's a little ambiguous as to how really spiritual Mordecai and Esther were. We do see, or there are some indications that they trust the Lord. But by and large, the Lord works behind the scenes in the book of Esther. But even while the Jewish people were not overtly and outwardly religiously trusting in the Lord, God still protects them from the attack of the Gentiles. God still protects the nation from Gentile attack. So we're going to see things like this, the sovereign providence of God and how God works providentially through different circumstances to bring about his purposes in history. By way of theme, we have a couple: preservation through providence, and also I like the way that the book of Esther unfolds. It's kind of like a divine chess game. What we see is the intent, the evil intent of man, versus the righteous and good intent of God. And we see how man, evil man, particularly Haman, is going to try and move the pieces on the chessboard in order to checkmate the Jews. And all the time we see God at work to reverse Haman's plans and bring blessing for them instead. So we see something of a divine chess game. And anyone who has a chess match with God, pretty clear who's going to win that and who's not going to win. So, a divine chess game. By way of the storyline, there are a few key players that we need to know about, that we need to know something about. And the first is King Ahasuerus. Okay, like I said, this is probably Xerxes, king over Persia. Xerxes, Ahasuerus, in the book of Esther, is characterized by a couple of things. First of all, he is very self-centered, and he is also very impressionable. All right, he is very self-centered. Ahasuerus doesn't sometimes come off looking the best because he doesn't think about what's beyond his nose on a couple of occasions. He's very much wrapped up in the moment and how he feels at that particular time. And as such, he can be very impressionable. He is very open to suggestion and oftentimes, several times throughout the book, manipulated and or persuaded. All right. And one of the things that you'll notice, what we come to in the book of Esther is the last of the books before the books that deal with the times of the Gentiles in the Old Testament. Okay, we have left Esther today, but then in the coming weeks, Ezra, Nehemiah, and also the book of Daniel. And what Daniel does is it prepares... Oh, and Chronicles as well, sorry. So what Daniel does, though, is it prepares the Jewish people for the time of the Gentiles. And we see the Gentile rulers be very consistent in their character. They're very self-centered. They're very impressionable. They are proud and easily manipulated. And above all, they are still under God's sovereign control. Okay? They are still under God's sovereign control. We see that even when it appears that all is lost for the Jewish people, for God's people, we see that even when it appears that God couldn't possibly be in control, even when we don't see his face, so to speak, God is in control of what happens with his people. So King Ahasuerus really sets the stage in the Hebrew Bible for the Gentile rulers, excuse me, who will dominate the last several books of the Old Testament. We also need to know and understand a little bit about Haman. Haman, Haman is a vindictive, crafty, and proud man. He is a prideful man, an evil man, and we see that Haman is a powerful man as well. He has done some things that have gotten him an in with King Ahasuerus. And the trouble for the Jews with Haman is the fact that Mordecai draws his ire. And so not only does he dislike Mordecai, not only does he hate Mordecai, he also hates his people, the Jews. So Haman is going to be the driver of the evil within the book. He's going to be the prime villain. Mordecai is also important for us to know. He is Esther's older cousin, uncle, sort of near relative, and really he becomes her adoptive father. Her parents apparently died when she was young, and he took her in. And we see that Mordecai is also a smart man. He's a wise man, but he is especially marked by a dedication to the welfare of the Jewish people. Obviously, he has some self-interest there. He is a Jew. And so, the better for his people, the better for him. But he is on the lookout for the Jewish people. He is also a wise man, as I said, and a smart guy. Finally, our main character is Esther. Esther is a beautiful and courageous and prudent young woman. She is a Jewish young woman. And she is our main character. She will really drive the action. It really very much... the book spins around her. So King Ahasuerus, Haman, Mordecai, and Esther, those are our major characters. We don't really see very much of very many other people at all in the book and in the narrative. So let's take a look. And like we've done with some of these historical books, some of these shorter historical books, what I want to do is kind of walk us through and hit the high points in the plot, and we'll point out some of the key concepts and key events in the book of Esther. And we'll do that as we bring out the outline. And if you were going to retitle Esther into like some sort of some sort of movie or book or something like that. Soap opera. We could call it As the Tables Turn. Or someone could call it One Night with the King. Isn't that what that one? I've seen that. Yeah, Melissa watched it on Netflix. Was it really good? You didn't? Oh, okay. Oh, Aaron and Audrey. Okay, that's all right. Was it pretty good?
Yeah.
All right, yeah. Very good. Very good. All right, so, but we could call it As the Tables Turn, because it's going to center around a couple of different events where the tables turn. As somebody sets up one thing, fortunes go from one person to another. And the first table that turns goes from Vashti to Esther. All right. Chapters 1 through the middle of chapter 1 and through the middle of chapter 2 really take time to set the background for us. They set the background for the plot, and they tell us how it is that Esther gets into the position that she is in. And we see that it all starts with a feast. King Ahasuerus, in chapter 1, we'll pick up in verse 3. In the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his princes and attendants, and the army officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his provinces, being in his presence. And he displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of the great of his great majesty for many days, 180 days. So we have a feast, and feasts are going to be key events throughout the book of Esther. We're going to see in each of these, there are two feasts, and in each, and a little speech that goes along with each. But this first feast, we see something of the arrogance, maybe, of Ahasuerus. We see that he has put on a 180-day-long feast just so everybody could see how rich he was. And probably what they are doing at this feast, he probably has gathered his major military leaders together, and this is probably where they plan the invasion of Greece. But he puts on the feast to display his wealth, and we find that it is a drunken feast. And what does a drunken king do who's putting on a feast to show off his wealth, but show off his wealth, right? And he calls for his wife. He calls for his wife Vashti, and we see that in verse 9. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the palace, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. And on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mahuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abgatha, Zethar, Carcass, that's a good one, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful. Queen Vashti says, I don't think so. It's a room full of drunken, powerful men. I know exactly what this is all for. He wants to show her off, and probably more of her than he ought. So she refuses, and he is obviously angry. And this is what happens when you get a bunch of guys who think they're smart, and you get them drunk, and you put them all together. His advisors say, O king, you can't let this happen, because if anybody hears that Vashti has turned you down like this, then all of the women in all of the kingdom are going to think that that's okay, that it's okay to treat their husbands that way. And so you can't let this offense stand, and you must do something. You must have her put to death or have her put away or something, because if word of this gets out, then this is a matter of national security, king. Yeah, they've probably blown this all out of proportion a bit. And they say, if it pleases the king, in verse 19, let a royal edict be issued by him, and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, so that it cannot be repealed, that Vashti should come no more into the presence of King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is more worthy than she. So what we see here is God providentially using even this drunken party in order to accomplish his purposes. because in removing Vashti from her place as king, he's going to use that to move Esther to where she needs to be, to where he wants her to be. Look in chapter 2, verse 1. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's attendants who served him said, "Let the beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. Let the king appoint overseers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather every beautiful young virgin to the citadel of Susa, to the harem, into the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let their cosmetics be given to them. And let the young lady who pleases the king be queen in place of Vashti." And the matter pleased the king, and he did accordingly. Now this is where we meet Esther. So the king gets lonely, decides he misses Vashti, and the king's attendants say, "Well, let's just go find another woman, right? Let's just have all of the beautiful women of the kingdom brought to you, O king, and you can pick, have your pick, have your choice out of all of these ladies as to who to make your queen." And of course, the king says, "Hey, that's a great idea." And here's where we meet. Here's where we meet a certain beautiful woman and her guardian. "Now there was at the citadel in Susa a Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives, and who had been exiled into with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. And he was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. Now the young lady was beautiful of form and of face, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter." So what we see here is Mordecai is of royal lineage, or was part of the people taken into captivity. Probably an important person and an important lineage. And he had come into the service of the king in Susa, King Ahasuerus, and his niece here, apparently a younger niece, had lost her parents, and he and his wife took her in, and they brought her up, and it just so happens that she is beautiful of form and of face. That's the Bible's way of saying she's gorgeous, right? So it just so happens again here that she is beautiful, she is gorgeous, and it just so happens that King Ahasuerus is looking for a gorgeous woman to be his queen. And what happens, obviously, is Hadassah, Esther, is taken to the king, and God puts her exactly where he wants to have her. Look at chapter 2, verse 16. "So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus to his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti." So there you have the tables turning here. Esther is made queen instead of Vashti. "Then the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his princes and his servants, and he also made a holiday for the provinces and gave gifts according to the king's bounty. When the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not yet made known her kindred or her people, even as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther did what Mordecai told her, as she had done when under his care." So you see that Mordecai understands that having her in this place could become a nice asset to have, a good asset to have for the people. And so he kind of want to keep who she is a little bit under wraps, just in case that becomes a useful time or a useful thing. So the first table that turns is the table of the queen, and we see how we go from Vashti to Esther. The next portion of the book is the meat of the book, and we see the tables turn, the tables of glory really turn from Haman to Mordecai. Okay? The tables turn from Haman to Mordecai. We find out something about Mordecai here as we open up this second part of the book, and that is that he is a valorous man, that he is dedicated to King Ahasuerus. Look at verse 21. In those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's officials from those who guarded the door, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. But the plot became known to Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. Now when the plot was investigated and found to be so, they were both hanged on a gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles of the king's presence. So we see Mordecai finds out about an assassination plot and foils it. He tells Esther to tell the king that these two guards of the door, these two officials, were going to try and kill King Ahasuerus. Now, obviously, at this point, Mordecai has two chips at the table, right? He understands that he's got Esther in a position of power and a position of influence over the king, and he's also done something to save the king's life. And you'll note also at this point that these two things just happen to fall in place. I say that with air quotes, right? These two things just happen to fall into place. It just happens that Esther is beautiful of face and form and wins favor with the king. It just happens that Mordecai hears about the plot to kill the king and warns him. And here's where we meet Haman. We see Haman's rise at the beginning of chapter 3 and his opposition to Mordecai. After these events, chapter 3, verse 1, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. All the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. Now, we don't know why Mordecai was like this. Maybe it's he's a proud man and is jealous of Haman. Maybe he knows and understands Haman's character. For whatever reason, though, Mordecai does not bow down to Haman, and obviously that doesn't sit well with Haman. And we see this happen a couple of times. When Haman walks by, everybody bows down, apparently except for Mordecai, and that becomes pretty clear. When everybody else is kind of like this and you're kind of like this, then you know, that kind of gets noticed, and it doesn't escape Haman's notice. Because of that, he draws Haman's ire. Haman said to King Ahasuerus, he wants to kill not just Mordecai. It's not enough for him to kill Mordecai. He finds out that Mordecai is a Jew, and so Haman's got it out not just for Mordecai, but for all of the Jews. He wants to kill them all. So he hatches a plan. Chapter 3, verse 7, in the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, that is, the lot, was cast before Haman from day to day, from month to month, until the 12th month, that is the month of Adar. So Haman has made this plot to kill the Jews, to wipe out the Jews in Persia, and he starts to cast lots every morning to see if this is the morning that he should bring his plot to the king, that he should propose this to the king. Now, who do we know from the Bible is in charge of the falling of the lots, the casting of the lots? The Lord is, right? It's going to become important again here. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of all other people, and they do not observe the king's laws, so it is not in the king's interest to let them remain. If it is pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business to put into the king's treasures." Then the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, "The silver is yours, and the people also, to do with them as you please." So really, Haman offers to bribe King Ahasuerus. He says, "I've got all this silver. I'm going to give it to you if we can. I'll donate it to the royal treasury," is what he says. If you allow me to enact this decree. And Ahasuerus says, okay, keep the silver. Here's my signet ring. The signet ring, obviously, is the seal that says this comes from the king. And he says, you write that decree up and you use the signet ring and you do whatever you want with the people. Word of this comes to Mordecai that the decree has been issued to kill all the Jews. You'll notice that Haman hasn't told Ahasuerus who the people is or anything like that. But we see that Mordecai comes up with a plan. Chapter 4, verses 9 through 17, we see Mordecai's plan and Esther's bravery. And Hathach came back and related Mordecai's words to Esther. Esther spoke to Hathach and ordered him to reply to Mordecai. Mordecai sits at the temple gate. He's come. He's torn his robes. He's in mourning, clearly. And one of Esther's attendants has come out and seen Mordecai and recognizes there's something wrong. And they go back and forth between the servant. And Mordecai tells Esther that Esther is going to have to go before the king and speak for the Jewish people. Now, that's a dangerous game, because if you go before the king without being called, unless the king extends his scepter and allows you to speak, then it's a capital offense, right? You lose your head to go before the king without being summoned. So there's a great deal on the line for Esther personally in this circumstance. Back in verse 11, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king, this is Mordecai has told Esther that she's going to have to go to the king and make a defense for the Jewish people. And she sends back and says that everybody knows that for any man or woman who comes to the king, to the inner court, who is not summoned, he has but one law, that he be put to death, unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter so that he may live. And I have not been summoned to the king for these 30 days. So it's been 30 days since the king has summoned for Esther. And they related Esther's words to Mordecai. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this." Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go, assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa, fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day, and I and my maidens also will fast in the same way. Thus I will go into the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went away and did just as Esther has commanded him. So Esther agrees to go in and speak for the Jews. We have that happen in chapter 5. Look at verse 2. "It happened that when the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court, she obtained favor in his sight." Again, a seemingly random event. "And the king extended to Esther the golden scepter, which was in his hand. So Esther came near and touched the top of the scepter." Skip down to verse 7. "So Esther replied, 'My petition and request is this. If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and do what I request, may the king and Haman come to the banquet, which I shall prepare for them. And tomorrow I will do as the king says.'" So she says she doesn't want to make her request right there. But she says, "Bring Haman to the feast that I prepare tomorrow." The king says, "Great, I'll call for Haman and we will come to this feast." Haman's response to this, Haman finds out that Queen Esther, remember that he doesn't know who she is yet, but Queen Esther wants to have him at a feast with the king all by themselves. And so his response is, he recounted them the glory of his riches. He goes to his friends and his wife. He recounts to them the glory of his riches, the number of his sons, every instance where the king had magnified him, and now he had promoted him above the princes and servants of the king. Haman also said, "Even Esther, the queen, let no one but me come with the king to the banquet which she had prepared, and tomorrow I am invited by her with the king." Yet all of this does not satisfy me. Every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting in the king's gate, then Zeresh his wife and all his friends said to him, have a gallows 50 cubits high made, and in the morning ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go joyfully with the king to the banquet. Let's have a hanging today. Yay, that makes my day better. And now I can go to the banquet and be happy. So the advice pleased Haman, and so he had the gallows made. And this is the part where the music would go, dun, 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 right? He has the gallows made. And that brings us to chapter 6. Verses 1 through 11 is the center of the chiasm of the book. Remember, we've talked about chiasm before. And what it does in Hebrew literature is it draws our attention to the center. Well, here's what it does. Chapter 6, verse 1. During that night, the king could not sleep. So he gave an order to bring the book of the records, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. Good cure for insomnia, right? This is like the court records and stuff like that. And it was found written, but where have we seen the book of the Chronicles before? Whose deeds were there?
Mordecai's,
right? Mordecai saved the king, and it was written in the books of the Chronicle of the king. And it was found written what Mordecai had reported concerning Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, who were doorkeepers, that they had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, what honor or dignity was bestowed on Mordecai for this? Then the king's servants who attended him said, nothing has been done for him. So the king said, who is in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace in order to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows, which he had prepared for him. The king's servants said to him, behold, Haman is standing in the court. And the king said, good, let him come in. So Haman came in, and the king said to him, what is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor? And Haman said to himself, whom could the king desire to honor more than me? Then Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king desires to honor, let them bring a royal robe, which the king has worn, and the horse on which the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown has been placed. Let the robe and the horse be handed over to the one of the king's most noble princes, and let them array the man whom the king desires to honor, and lead him on horseback through the city square, and proclaim before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. And then the king said to Haman, take quickly the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who is sitting in the king's gate. Do not fall short in anything of all that you have said. It would have been interesting to see the look on Haman's face. So Haman took the robe and the horse and arrayed Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city square and proclaimed before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. Wow. The ultimate turn of the tables there, right? Haman is going to ask that this man be executed because he hates him, basically. And instead, he leads him around on the king's horse in the king's robes and says, this is the guy that the king wants to honor. And we see that it gets worse for Haman in chapter 7. Now the king and Haman came to drink wine with Esther the queen. And the king said to Esther on the second day, also as they drank their wine at the banquet, what is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you, and what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be done. Then Queen Esther replied, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, if it pleases the king, let my life be given me as my petition, and my people as my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated. If we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with the annoyance to the king. Then King Ahasuerus asked Queen Esther, who is he? And where is he who would presume to do this? And I would be interested to see the look on Haman's face again right now as he hears this request begin to unfold. A foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman. And Haman became terrified before the king and queen. The king arose in his anger from drinking wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm had been determined against him by the king. I'm sure that wasn't very hard to see. It's interesting. Haman starts to beg, and he starts to like grab hold of Esther and beg for his life. And the king comes back in as he's grabbing a hold of her, and he says, so now you're even gonna attack the queen? And of course, Haman is hanged on the very gallows that he had built for Mordecai immediately. And the tables turn in glory, in death, between Haman and Mordecai. But we still have the problem of the decree that's been issued. We still have the problem of the decree, and that's where we see the tables turn for the Jews from calamity to good in chapters 8 through 10. Here's the plea that Esther goes on to make in chapter 8, verse 3. Esther spoke again to the king and fell at his feet and wept and implored him to avert the evil scheme of Haman the Agagite and his plot which he had devised against the Jews. But here's the problem, verse 8. Now you write to the Jews as you see fit in the king's name and seal it with the king's signet ring. For a decree which is written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's signet ring may not be revoked. There's no veto here. Once you've made the law, once it's been signed into law, he can't undo the proclamation, the edict that he has issued before. So he says, look, here's what you can do though. You can make another proclamation, you can make another edict that counters the edict that I made in some way, shape, or form. And they do exactly that. Mordecai's solution is this, in verse 11, chapter 8. In them the king granted the Jews, who were in each and every city, the right to assemble and defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate the entire army of any people or province which might attack them, including children and women, and to plunder their spoil. So Mordecai writes up the edict and he says, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to give the Jews the right to get together and to defend themselves from any attack on this day. They're going to have the right to defend themselves from their attackers and then also to take spoil from the attackers. And the outcome is this, chapter 9, verse 1, in the 12th month, that's the month of Adar, on the 13th day, when the king's command and edict were about to be executed, on the day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, it was turned to the contrary. So you have this final turning of the tables. It was turned to the contrary so that the Jews themselves gained mastery over those who hated them. So what we see is that God is in control still. He has brought his purposes to bear through his providence. And so some of the major themes we've seen, just to list them out, we've seen God's providence. There's no mention of God's name throughout the book, but we see that circumstances turn out to bring God's purposes to bear. You have a bunch of drunk wise guys whose decision brings Esther to the throne. You have a pretty girl who ascends to the throne. You have Mordecai in the right place at the right time to foil a plot against the king. You have Esther's acceptance before Ahasuerus. You have the king's insomnia. You have Haman's timing. All of these things. Also allusions directly to God's providence, the casting of lots, the oversight of the Jews. All of these things are brought to bear. We see that God is providentially in control. Even when things seem awful, even when the things seem at their darkest. You have the reversal of plans, as we brought out, and the Jewish people are key in this as well. There's a hatred and a fear of them on the part of the Persians, but we see that God is the one who delivers them. So there's the book of Esther. It'll prepare us for the times of the Gentiles as we consider the book of Daniel, and then Ezra, Nehemiah, and Chronicles going forward. So let's pray. Father, thank you so much for this time that we have together this morning. Just to ask that you would be pleased by our worship, by our fellowship, and that you would be honored. I pray that you would bless our time in the services this morning. Pray for the kids as they prepare for the program tonight. Pray for those who come, especially this evening, for their hearts and minds to be prepared to hear the message of the gospel in Christmas. Lord, we pray these things in your Son's name. Amen.